In electronic music, the sounds are derived from electronic tone generators. Here's a sound produced by striking a china bowl. Now, played in reverse. By this method, various kinds of rhythmic backgrounds or repetitive phrases may be produced.
Music is science. Music is incredibly technical. When you're studying music, there is an enormous corollary between science and art and music and engineering.
The potential of electronic music depends how you define it. Has music from machines reached its peak? Well, there's no real limit.
There's a secret history of British electronic music. Part of the reason it's secret is because of what happened in the 50s and 60s in the UK and how perhaps many in the music establishment were confused by the potential of electronic music composition. As a result, there's a lot of British electronic music sort of forced underground.
Shortly after World War II, a small community of eccentrics, boffins and innovators began to tinker with their military surplus electrical kit, looking for ways to create a new form of music. I'm Stuart Lee. I'm a stand-up comedian, and I'm the only radio-friendly E-list celebrity the programme makers could find who'd ever been to a Stockhausen concert. And so, in this programme, it's me who's going to trace the stories of just a few of the early electronic musical pioneers and investigate their attempts to get their brave new work heard. We'll hear how radio drama and TV opened its doors to the first stirrings of electronic sound in the 50s, and how it went on to be embraced by the new pop elite of the late 60s and made its way into the musical mainstream of today. This intrepid group of electronic pioneers of 60 years ago had a make-do-and-mend approach, their kit laid out on kitchen tables, their tools spread in garden sheds. Composer and sound designer Mark Ayres.
In the UK, it was very much a cottage industry, electronic music. It was very much down to individual experimenters. There were lots of eccentrics and interesting people involved. One of my favourites is a chap called Desmond Leslie. He was a Spitfire pilot. He wrote one of the early books on flying saucers. But Desmond started experimenting with electronic music and again put a lot of tapes together at home, which later ended up on the Joseph Weinberger Library and used again in programmes like Doctor Who. Desmond Leslie is most famous for being the person who punched Bernard Levin for giving his wife's play a nasty review. So there was all these little cottage industries, but it wasn't really taken seriously in the UK as it was certainly on the continent, and that's why it was very much hobbyists, very serious hobbyists like Tristram Cary, but still hobbyists.
Tristram Cary was an ex-Navy man, and his early work would find its way into BBC radio drama. For many, Cary is the founding father of British electronic music. Composer and inventor Peter Zinoviev.
Tristram Cary had the sort of best tape studio in Britain, in Fressingfield, and he was a very professional electronic musician. He not only was a composer in his own right of purely electronic pieces, but he wrote a lot of film music and music for BBC and to accompany other things.
Cary died in 2008, but here he is speaking to the BBC 40 years ago.
It seemed to me that the idea of defining music as something that comes out of a musical instrument was hopelessly blinkered. There is no reason why any sound should not be considered as music. Just as a collage painter will stick bits of flannel onto canvas, there's no reason why this should not be part of a painting.
I met Tristram after I'd worked myself on Doctor Who as a composer in the late 1980s, and we became very good friends. He was trained musician, came from a very bohemian, artistic family, went into the war as a radio operator. And it was while listening to shortwave radio signals during the war that he realised that there was music in there, and that radio circuits, when they used to feed back and go into heterodyning and all this sort of weird interference sounds, were actually making something which was, in its own way, bewitching. And he wanted to harness that sound. He thought, yes, there is music in here. I want to grab that out of the ether and I want to create music out of it. So that's what he did. When he was demobbed, he spent his demob pay on army surplus electronic equipment. He had a home studio in his front room
For many years, I used to go down the junk shops in Edgware Road and other parts of London and transform what junk I could find, you know. In the early days, when it was much more use of mechanical gadgets, you know, special tape recorders with funny heads. This was also very exciting, the feeling that you could go into your own workshop and come out with a tape and say, well, that's a piece. All you've got to do is to put it on and listen to it.
And it took a while before he found a use for what he was doing. And in 1955, he got two big commissions. He got a commission for The Lady Killers, the famous Alec Guinness film, for which he provided a conventional orchestral score. But he also got a commission from BBC Radio to provide an electronic score for a play called The Japanese Fisherman, which was about a fishing boat off the coast of Japan when the atom bomb hit. The Japanese Fisherman was the first commission for BBC Radio for electronic music. Tristram got a lot of stick for it, he recalled, because people didn't understand what he was doing. But it went into the melting pot of what was happening at the BBC at the time. So what Tristram was doing went into that big pot, which was being stirred within the BBC by people like Desmond Briscoe and Daphne Oram at the same time.
A lot of early electronic music. I found it very cold and a little bit scary and spooky and not very inviting at all.
Adrian Utley of the group Portishead.
We were brought up with that strange adverts with electronic weird cut-up music and the kind of electronic realisations of Coke, bubbles and pops and things, but a kind of new world of advertising and really weird.
Do your wash the new way, the tumble wash way. The Liberator tumble wash costs only 75 guineas, and look what it does for you. It washes, it rinses, and it spins, all in one tub. Turn one dial to heat the water as hot as you want. Turn another dial to wash, with a gentle tumbling action that forces suds through every fibre. You never touch the clothes yourself until they're spun and sparkling clean. Wonderful tumble wash. The only 75-guinea one-tub washing machine.
That was a 50-year-old TV commercial for English electric washing machines, only 75 guineas each. Daphne Oram wrote the quirky and intricate music you heard there. She was a composer and a great advocate for electronic sound. During the Second World War, Oram became an engineer at the BBC. Along with Desmond Briscoe, she campaigned within the corporation for the provision of electronic facilities for creating sounds and music. Eventually, in 1958, the BBC agreed to set up the Radiophonic Workshop. Daphne Oram and others like her had found their spiritual home.
What Desmond and Daphne were doing was, after hours and everybody else had gone home, they were wandering around the corridors of Broadcasting House, nicking bits of gear, wheeling them down the corridors into a studio, putting it all together, experimenting overnight.
I knew Daphne quite well.
Composer, engineer, and the man who created the sound of the TARDIS, Brian Hodgson.
Daphne was a lovely lady, completely eccentric, immense visionary. She actually created a machine which there was no equal of until the Fairlight music computer in the 70s. I mean, it looked a mess. It was all made of Dexian and sprocketed tape, and it's about the size of a large dining table. It was built using a lot of government surplus equipment. You basically can then instruct the pitch. So if you want to come on gradually and fade away or come on abruptly and change the volume of the sound during the note, you control the echo and reverberation. I mean, it really was quite staggeringly advanced, but it worked, and she made music on it.
I found her rather dull.
Peter Zinoviev knew Daphne Oram.
I mean, I didn't really get on with her. A bit sort of schoolmarmish. And although there's now a big fuss about a machine which has been reconstituted at the Science Museum, the Oramics machine, it was a completely wild idea by somebody who wasn't very scientific. She was a perfectionist.
I know that a lot of people say she was a really annoying, irritating woman.
Senior lecturer in creative computing at Goldsmiths College, Dr. Michael Grierson.
That may well be true, but that doesn't stop the fact that you can't separate music-making composition from tool-making if you're really doing genuine research. And she built the first British electronic music composition system. We've got a recording of her while she was creating the Oramics machine It's just a piece of music that she's made, and it doesn't have a title. There is no name for this piece of music. I'm just making something entirely new with a machine I've built myself. And that moves me the most, where you've had the vision. I wish I could make music in different ways. And then to realise it and not know what it is.
In the 50s, Daphne Oram was part of a new clique of British composers finding inventive ways of creating sounds and music with new and suddenly affordable tape machines. They used these to adapt Pierre Schaeffer's Music Concrète approach to making their own sounds. Composer Mark Ayres.
Music Concrète is taking the sound of, like, I mean, I've got a glass of water here, so I can... That is a source of Music Concrète. So I could record that onto a piece of tape, I could speed it up, slow it down, play it backwards, put it through echo chambers, all sorts of things, and create new sounds out of found sounds, and creating music out of that kind of sound.
In the 60s, the French avant-garde approach to electronic music found an unlikely home as incidental music for BBC Radio's Woman's Hour.
Woman's Hour's water bottle music for reading your letters. It was composed and produced in the BBC's radiophonic workshop by John Baker, and we've asked him to tell us about it.
The basic sound used for this music was made from a recording of water being slowly poured from a cider bottle. By taking just one of these sounds, all the notes that were wanted were made by playing the tape back at various speeds. The faster the tape goes, the higher the pitch. To get a rhythm track, I used the sound of a cork being pulled from a bottle. The tape was again played at different speeds, and the sound cut into a rhythm. By mixing these tapes together and adding some electronic echo, we end up with 8 seconds of music.
And perhaps abstract electronica like that could again play a crucial role in expanding the Woman's Hour brand as the perfect contrast to Top Gear's manly soft rock soundbeds. Meanwhile, 50 years ago, the key difference between British electronic music pioneers and their European counterparts was simple. On the continent, experiments in electronic music were taken seriously and publicly funded.
By the end of the 1950s, you know, when Tristram stuff was coming out, when the Radiophonic Workshop was formed, when Peter Novius was getting involved, different cultures have different views of the arts. In Europe, however, it's very much art for art's sake. And so there were two big studios in particular in Europe. There was the French radio studio started by Pierre Schaeffer, which was mainly involved with Music Concrète, real sounds recorded and turned into music. And a studio in Cologne, which was set up largely to do with electronic music. Both of those studios were set up to produce art music. In the UK, music was regarded very much as music. You know, music, you got musicians to play music. And so this new form wasn't music.
If you wanted to make electronic music in the 50s and 60s in the UK, it seems that in that environment, it's very difficult to find funding to support what you want to do. It seems almost as if it's not valued as something which can even represent Britain culturally. So you have to do other things.
Power foam. Omo's power foam is the hardest working foam. See, the thick, rich lather shows you Omo's cleaning power goes on working. Working. See, it knocks the toughest dirt out. Omo's power foam is the longest working foam. Omo with power foam.
That's a great shame, making adverts, and a lot of doing stuff which perhaps isn't what you set out to do in the first place. It's hard to imagine how that could have happened in any other country. We should respect those who want to push boundaries culturally in terms of engineering and technology. It's an important part of what we are.
Electronic music here was not taken seriously. It was all down to people experimenting at home. Tristram with his home studio, Fred Judd with his home studio. That's the way electronic music was done. On the continent, it was being taken very seriously by the broadcasters, and they set up publicly funded electronic music studios.
50 years ago, British children's television was an early adopter of electronic music. Space Patrol, the ITV sci-fi puppet show, was the first series to feature an all-electronic score by the self-taught composer and inventor Fred Judd.
This is Earth, the year 2100. This is the headquarters of Space Patrol. And men from Earth, Mars, and Venus live and work there as guardians of peace.
Then, thanks to a new BBC series launched 23rd of November 1963, the Radiophonic Workshop would be a regular weekly fixture in homes all across the UK.
There was an enormous amount of education and changing of attitudes needed to take place before people would start realising that electronic music was music. Certainly in the early days at the BBC, a great suspicion of electronic music. Music was what musicians played. Memos went round this department at the Radiophonic Workshop wouldn't be producing music, would it? Because the BBC employed orchestras to create all the music it needs. Doctor Who was one of those gifts for the form when it started up in 1963. Tristram Carey was approached to writing the incidental music and possibly the theme music for Doctor Who, but it didn't happen. Instead, the commission eventually went to Ron Grainer, and he wrote quite a simple tune, which was then given to Delia Derbyshire at the BBC Radiophonic Workshop to turn into the theme. And Brian Hodgson at the Radiophonic Workshop created all the sound effects, like the TARDIS taking off.
It's hard now, if you look back, to think of the impact of that signature tune. Jaws dropped when they heard it. We were sort of like that dirty secret the BBC has got, but it was always set up as to provide music for programmes. It took a long time to teach people how to work at any speed in the workshop in those days, because the equipment was just non-standard. It was whatever you happened to get at the time. And it was set up as an experimental unit. You see, and we didn't really have proper professional tape recorders until 1964, I think it was. Once we started to get professional equipment in the workshop, then it certainly made a big difference.
British pop music was slow in embracing electronic sound. The Gloucestershire outsider, Joe Meek, seemed to be the only creative producer who understood its potential. He used it on some of his hits of the 60s, like Telstar. Then, in 1966, at Abbey Road Studios, while working on their Revolver album, the Beatles began experimenting with tape loops, an early electronic technique. Their producer, George Martin, explained more to the BBC.
All the boys were very keen on playing about with tape recorders at home. And by taking off the erase head on a recorder, you can build up sounds so that they go on forever almost. So they would make most peculiar noises. And they would bring me their loops. And out of about 30 loops, I chose 8. We played them at various speeds to determine the right one. Sometimes we played them backwards, even though they were made forwards. And by feeding them into the control panel, together with the original sounds, the drums and the voice and the tambura drone, and bringing them in and out as we wanted to, we were able to paint our little picture. Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream. It is not dying. It is not dying. Lay down all thoughts, surrender to the void. It is shining.
So the pop world started to embrace this new way of creating odd sounds. So George Martin was using reverse tape techniques and reverse guitars with the Beatles. There was all that weird experimentation going on, and people realised that once you had stuff on tape, music was no longer something which just happened. It was something you could then alter, you could engineer, you could play with, you could mould like clay. And obviously the pop fraternity was going to grab hold of that.
The Beatles with their tape loop composition Tomorrow Never Knows, the closing track of the Revolver album, released summer 1966. Soon, the Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd and the Pretty Things would mix electronic sounds into their music. It was around this time that Peter Zinoviev formed a creative alliance called Unit Delta Plus.
First of all, I had a very nice studio built over the river, and I never charged composers or people to work there. When I'd moved to Putney, two people in the radiophonic workshop, Brian Hodgson and Delia Derbyshire, came and approached me and said, would I like to join forces with them?
Unit Delta Plus did quite a lot of stuff.
I think we made terrible music together, all of us. We did one jingle, which sold for Philips.
Unit Delta Plus didn't, in fact, last very long. But we did, let's see, Macbeth at Stratford. We did Lear, also at Stratford, I think. We did the Medea for the Greenwich Theatre, little bits of commercials.
The studio, it was never perfect. It was always going to be a bit better the next day. I tell you what, we had a succession of such famous people. Anybody in sort of music tended to come. I was rather snooty. I was much more interested in Stockhausen coming than in Paul McCartney coming, actually.
And people would sort of drop in and out. It was part of the normal thing.
Paul McCartney came to lunch once or twice. We did do one thing, this rave at Roundhouse with Paul McCartney. I've got a poster of it there.
That chaotic event at the Roundhouse. Nobody ever bothered telling us that. We were just sort of busy working on a programme. Next minute we seemed to find ourselves at the Roundhouse handing in tapes, one of which was the piece from Paul, because he was fascinated by the whole thing.
McCartney's tape, a 15-minute experimental sound collage called Carnival of Light, was thrown together with the other Beatles. After that one airing at the Roundhouse, it remains locked in the vaults to this day. Unit Delta Plus, based in Peter Zinoviev's studio, was short-lived, but Delia Derbyshire and Brian Hodgson, along with David Vorhouse, went on to produce the first British electronic pop album.
Well, Delia and Brian, particularly at the Radiophonic Workshop during the day, was working to deadlines. So the other thing that Brian and Delia did, which is has been enormously influential, was to team up with David Vorhouse. They were signed to Island and given the budget to make this album, and in a massive rush of creativity came up with this quite extraordinary record, which is still one of the most bizarre, horrific listens. White Noise and Electric Storm. But that was enormously influential, I think, that album, and still is.
White Noise, yeah, Electric Storm in Hell. Remember somebody getting me stoned and putting this record on, me and my friend, and it just freaked me out completely. I couldn't understand it at all. I had no idea where it was coming from, you know. It was so potent and so completely weird as well, really off-centre, not at all like any other music that was around.
Adrian Utley of Portishead, still reeling after hearing the album An Electric Storm by White Noise, released in the summer of 1969. Later that year, the first British synthesizer, the VCS3, went on sale. It was developed by EMS, a company set up by Tristram Cary, engineer David Cockerell and Peter Zinoviev.
We invented these small synthesizers, and the first was the VCS3, and these took off and sold very well. We didn't make them in Putney, we had a factory, and so any profit from any of the synthesizers went straight back into the studio.
Peter was very interested in computers, and in fact was another visionary.
I also hated demonstrating. It was one of my sort of bête noires, was having to show what these little machines could do, because, first of all, I didn't really know what they could do.
It was a scientific instrument, really. It had little vernier dials on it and little pin patch matrix where you could reorganise all the little circuits that it contained within it to create different sounds.
It's not your normal musical instrument.
Senior lecturer at Goldsmiths College, Dr. Michael Grierson again.
What's key about the VCS3 is you don't play it like a harpsichord or a piano. You put tiny little metal sticks in a load of holes on a piece of metal, and that makes the music. And so the whole concept of music making is different. It's a sound making practice.
Although you could also, using the patch panel, program it to play almost complete pieces, which would go on for hours if you were very clever with it, which of course many people were.
Everybody was cleverer than me, and I fumbled so much. I couldn't remember. Anyway, it was always like that. So the serious musicians who couldn't control the equipment.
If you want to make new music, you need new tools. So how much is this process of new music making related to the process of instrument development? For me, it's all about that. That's definitely the case with the EMS, with Peter Zinoviev. Certainly what became the EMS, that was a critical part of technological development. And I'd say that had a bigger impact on a number of composers than any single person.
And Ringo Starr bought one BCS3, and I used to go and teach him in his garden in Hampstead, put the pins in the right ways, but I don't think it was their thing, really. It wasn't like Pink Floyd, who really got together with these synthesizers and made very good sounds. On stage, we used to have lots of VCS3s. I only went to one Pink Floyd concert, and I thought it was marvellous. But it didn't mean that I listened to their music, actually, ever.
Pink Floyd switching on their EMS synthesizers for the track On the Run from Dark Side of the Moon. By the time Pink Floyd released their epic album of 1973, electronic music had found its way into the musical mainstream. Today, the digitization of all our lives has put at our fingertips sounds and techniques that were once the preserve of a small band of electronic musicians. We can now do with a press of a button what would once have taken hours of tape editing. Electronic music is everywhere. In fact, it's so much a part of the background buzz of modern life, we barely even notice it anymore. But the music made by those pioneering individuals in the 50s and 60s still resonates with today's music makers. Perhaps for them, this particular sound adventure still continues.
I'm working on a film score at the moment, and I'm going back to loads of old techniques as well as using a string section. There's life in those old boxes. They are fantastic pieces of equipment, and you can still find inspiration.
What's really interesting is there's a whole new generation of interesting electronic music composers who have got a really good grasp of what they want to do.
And also, it all depends on your imagination. I'm now working on taking the sounds from a chain ferry in Cornwall, and inside that sound there are thousands of little tiny sounds, so there's no end. I suppose it's more like saying, is poetry at an end because we've got a dictionary?
I'm Stuart Lee. A Sound British Adventure was produced by John Sugar, written and researched by Mark Brend, and the programme was a Sugar production for BBC Radio 4.